Good morning. Hawaii Democrats weighed in. Sanders is their pick, and younger voters are part of the big push. Neil Milner looks at why that's a good idea in some recent research on millennials and politics. And with a week to go in the comment period on the draft joint fact-finding report on pesticide use on Kauai, Earth Justice attorney Paul Achitoff talks about why his group thinks the EPA will do better. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergood. There are always new ways of looking at Hawaii, and chances are you'll see them at Pacific New Media's exhibit, Contemporary Photography in Hawaii 2016. And the tea ceremony is at the heart of traditional Japanese culture. The Lauai International Center on Kauai invites the public to learn more this weekend.
It's Wednesday, March 30th. That's the conversation starting right after this news. Good morning to you, whether you're down by the schoolyard or not. We're glad you're with us this morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation. And good morning to you, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Many signs that young people are more engaged in electoral politics than they have been in past
or that
presidential cycles.
Yeah. We've been willing to say that they are. We're going to talk about that part this morning. Now, last Saturday, Hawaii Democrats overwhelmingly said they preferred Bernie Sanders. Still, to look at who polls well for Sanders, you could call him the kids' candidate. In every primary and caucus, he does markedly better with young voters than Hillary Clinton. But relying on the youth vote is a risky strategy, as young people are the least likely to vote, or so we've heard. Then again, there have been some notable departures in the not-so-long view. Contributing editor Neil Milner is back with some recent research that shows that millennials are indeed politically and civically engaged. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so you're going to myth bust here a little bit, because mostly we talk about how if you're, you know, in the early years of voting, that unless you are tremendously moved, you're probably not going to vote. But this looks like a year where we have a lot of young people who feel tremendously moved.
Well, maybe, maybe not. They're tremendously moved now, but the likelihood is that they will have the lowest turnout of any age group. That's just always the case. It may be higher than last time. And what usually happens is that people then go ahead and blame young people for being selfish, in this case, millennials and narcissistic, and all of those kinds of things, and the sign of a general malaise. And there's been some recent research that looks at that kind of question. But I think the pattern is pretty clear. You do have a lot of folks working for Sanders, just as you had a lot of folks, young folks, working for Obama. But when push comes to shove, their turnout is not as great as other age groups. And there's been a lot of studies that show that if you have to depend on the youth vote, you're not going to win the presidency.
It sounds a little bit like that old Bye Bye Birdie song, What's the Matter with Kids Today? But that's not really what I'm hearing you say in sort of the fullness of all of it. That really is. There are those subtleties and those nuances that we have to take notice of and not try to paint it so well.
Yeah, it's really not subtle. It's some interesting research by Russell Dalton, social scientist at the University of California, Irvine. He's compared the political activity of youths. We call them millennials now, but young voters in 1967, 1987, 2014. And there's some standard kinds of questions. And what's interesting is this. The millennials, compared to the other younger groups in those two other years, are slightly less likely to vote, but they're more likely to participate in politics and in civic affairs in other ways. They're more likely to work with groups. They're more likely to do kind of consumer boycotts. They're more likely to participate in politics through social media. That is, that they're more heavily engaged than young people used to be. And then there's this study at UCLA that does this kind of, you participate in various ways. They say that the last time they did this, which I think was last year, they had college students were more involved in those kind of civic activities than were any other of the cohort groups that they had done in the past.
But you mentioned a very important differing issue with the last cohort as opposed to the other ones in 67 and 87. They didn't have social media.
That's exactly right. And so there are two things going on here that we have to understand. One of which is that the millennials are participating in ways that we don't always that we understand are important, but in years of elections we tend to emphasize voting so much. So the first thing is to see that they are involved in civic affairs much more readily, and the second thing is that they're involved in new ways that lots of people, older people, still don't pay as much attention to, and that's social media. So when you talk about consumer boycotts, for example, and you talk about protests, both of which the millennials are more likely to be involved with than, say, the earlier groups, that has something to do with the use of social media to organize those things.
But bring this back to what we've been seeing recently, which is that Bernie Sanders resonates really well with younger voters, and they seem to be turning out.
Well, they're turning. Well, I don't know if they're turning out. You don't hear about turnout. You hear about support. And there is a big difference. There's a kind of chaotic way that we report on caucuses and primaries. It's still not clear to me whether more young people are working in this campaign than in the past. But the bottom line, and then I want to move away from the election thing that we don't emphasize the voting thing too much, but the bottom line is that you can bet the house on the fact that their turnout is going to be lower than the turnout of people who are older. Now, it might be higher than it was in 2012. I'm not sure that's the case. But that they're a low voter turnout group. What I'm trying to get across is that doesn't mean that they're not politically engaged or civically engaged in other ways.
And it's those other ways that you think we need to be looking at
yeah.
a lot more deeply, because it might be far more important for someone to be turning up weekly or monthly or whatever to an organization and be involved with ongoing activity than necessarily just turning out to vote?
I think that's right. I think that we overemphasize voting not in a kind of rationality way, but in a moral way. That is, we tend to see people's citizenship in terms of whether they vote. And I'm suggesting here that what happens with young people is that they get labeled as being not caring. What I'm suggesting here is broaden your scope, that civic work, that other kinds of political work, which is more under the radar, is arguably more important in everyday life than voting. Now, there's no reason you have to make a choice. There's no reason that a college kid can't get out of the dorm and go and vote. I'm not saying that that's unimportant, and sure, you should vote. But there are all these other kinds of activities that young people are in. And by the way, that was some of my experience when I was teaching at UH, that I was always amazed at how much community work these students did. But that's an important part of civic affairs. And it also suggests that Robert Putnam and some of these other people who see the lack of conventional participation as a sign of malaise may be too pessimistic, that you have to look in some different places that are very valued places.
Too pessimistic, or just looking with a very narrowed lens?
Well, they're too pessimistic. They generalize from that. They generalize about the political malaise. Now, there is a kind of cynicism, the degree of cynicism and distrust and skepticism about political candidates that's quite high among all age groups. But there are other things going on that are incredibly important to the way we carry on our public affairs, maybe at smaller scale, that we have to recognize. And when we run into these presidential campaigns, it's all too easy to forget about those and to stigmatize non-voters, assuming that they don't care at all. Just one final point about this. When I was learning about political participation, you basically learned that if you didn't vote, that was an indication of being politically unattached. It turns out that was not exactly right, that we now see that there is something more that you have to look at.
For the moment, we're going to let that stand, and we'll see how this begins to play out later and be watching the millennials a little more closely with a little more subtlety. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Neil Milner is our contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. He'll be back in a couple of weeks.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13, and coming up, our islands as seen through the contemporary photographer's lens. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a bird that does what a great many humans do. It flies its mainland home, or rather, it flees its mainland home, and it flies to spend the coldest months in Hawaii. The bird has to do its own flying, of course, and it does it in a 3,000-mile flight from Alaska with no stops along the way to rest or feed. It builds its nests and raises its young on the Alaskan tundra between the months of May and August, and then changes its plumage from black and white to gold and brown. For the next 8 months, it lives in Hawaii, foraging for food in beaches and tidal flats, eating insects, crustaceans, and some berries, too. Its Hawaii migration is one of those miracles of nature. Scientists don't know how even the youngest birds of this species are able to find their way across 3,000 miles of open ocean to find the Hawaiian Islands. Today, we're looking for the English and Hawaiian names of this remarkable creature. We'll be back with it in half an hour. Meanwhile, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the HPR T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Lynn Finnegan from Hawaii Public Charter Schools Network. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Everything about Hawaii invites the photographer, from the quality of the light to the variety of subjects it offers, and each new generation finds new ways to shoot it. You can trace the way perceptions are shifting through the annual exhibit Contemporary Photography in Hawaii 2016, which brings together dozens of points of view. The show has just opened, and David Ulrich is here to tell us what to expect. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
All right. The obvious temptation for the photographer in Hawaii is the beauty shot, right?
Well, one of the things that really interests me about this show mm-hmm. is I've been looking at it now for the 8 years that we've been producing it, mm-hmm. and I'm seeing a difference between what I would call the pictorial image, mm-hmm. where people are looking at beauty, they're looking at the prettiness of Hawaii, mm-hmm. compared to photographs that have meaning and substance and are dealing with what I would call substantial issues. And what I'm seeing is a trend. This particular show has a lot more images that I think have substance and meaning. Mm-hmm. And even the field of entries from which we chose the show, there were far fewer sunsets and palm trees.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's a relief. And it also makes me think that as far as sunsets and palm trees, there aren't that many places left to go.
There aren't that many places left to go. And
for
don't
the
get
photographer,
me wrong.
Right?
Right. I think that everyone uses a camera to document the moments that are important to them. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, includes sunsets and the environment in which that they're in. But the camera can also be used as a powerful artistic or documentary tool. And sure. What we're trying to do is to support the photographic community in Hawaii that is using a camera for what I would call the dealing with issues that have meaning and substance.
How do you do that? I mean, what's an example of that, David?
Well, when you look at the show, you're going to see a wide variety of visions, and you're going to see a number of people that are working in a documentary format. And those people are focusing on many things that are important in Hawaii, like family or mm-hmm. neighborhoods mm-hmm. or the changing environment. One of the photographs in the show that interests me a great deal is by Allison Best, who's one of our faculty members. And the title of the image is Light Pollution Grid. It's 16 squares, a collage of photographs dealing with the air and light pollution that exists around the time of dusk. The photographs are incredibly beautiful, but the paradox is that the subject matter is something that has problematic meaning.
Sure. And when you get to a place where it doesn't have light pollution, you realize how much we, certainly on Oahu, miss at dusk because there's a haze over the horizon.
Right.
You're not seeing the stars emerging that you would see if you were in a completely pristine rural area.
And the irony is of a beautiful sunset is very often the more beautiful sunsets are caused by pollution.
Yeah. Well, when after the Mount Pinatubo eruption for a good year, we had spectacular sunsets because of all the sulfur dioxide in the air, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's pretty interesting to me. The other interesting aspect of the show is we're no longer finding a sharp division between what I'm going to call professional cameras and cell phone cameras.
Yeah.
When you look at the show, you're not going to be able to tell the difference between an image that may be made with a cell phone and an image made with a digital SLR camera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're finding that the quality of the cameras that people carry in their pockets every day is getting much better. And we're finding that people are using those cameras as a sketching device to sketch out ideas that I think is really helping their vision and ultimately helping the kind of work that we're seeing in the community.
There's clearly a great deal to be gained by that, David. What is lost by that?
Well, in 1889 or something like that, Kodak put out a little box and you press the button, we do the rest. And the whole question of the snapshot or reflexive photography where you're photographing something that you respond to in your immediate environment,
yeah,
I think is a wonderful thing for the vernacular of one's life and of American life.
Mm-hmm.
I think the danger is, are you still attending to the world itself, or are you walking around taking selfies and photographing your food?
Mm-hmm.
For me, one of the things as a photography teacher, I would have to say, look up is the new slogan. I was teaching a group the other day, and we were looking at photographs of students in the woods looking at their cell phones. And I asked the students, I said, what do you find more interesting? Is it nature or is it what's on your phone? And they said with a very straight face, well, of course, it's what's on our phone. So to me, the danger is getting too absorbed in this miniature 4-inch screen.
Yeah, and yeah, so much is clearly lost for that. I was just thinking how horrified Ansel Adams would have been to hear something like that. But, you know, the whole idea of finding, I mean, especially in Hawaii, the beauty of nature is laid right out there. You can get it with a point-and-shoot camera. Just walk to the beach, point it outward as the sun is going down. What's to know? But the photographer who selects and manipulates images using the tools that a camera gives you. I'm talking about exposure length, lens aperture, type of film stock or type of color, temperature in a digital realm. You know, those are all ways that you can select something in an image and kind of make the selection that, to me, is sort of a degree deeper into the art of photography.
Yes, I mean, that is absolutely the art and skill of photography. We need to learn to see how a camera sees.
Yeah.
Once you learn the choices you can make and how to control those choices, you're not just reflecting the world. You're creating the world in a sense. You're mm-hmm. creating an image that is an experience unto itself for the viewer. So, yes, I think that even though photography has become much easier, the level of skill, the level of attention required to become good at it hasn't really changed. And I think that there's an intimate relationship between the technical side and the visual side, because as you're looking and as you're seeing, you're constantly surveying your brain, making choices.
Yeah. Yeah, what's my shutter speed going to be? How much depth of field do I want? What lens shall I use? That's the thing. I think we both feel the same way. We don't want to see that lost, right?
Right, exactly. You know, my brother was a pure math major in college, and at an ice cream store, he once said, every time you get an ice cream sundae, you're choosing one of 65,000 possible combinations. It's the same every time you make a photograph. You're choosing one of any number of possible combinations.
I'm going to remember that analogy. Thanks so much, David.
You're welcome.
David Ulrich is one of the curators of the exhibit Contemporary Photography in Hawaii 2016, the 8th annual survey exhibition sponsored by Pacific New Media at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. It runs until April 9th at the Arts at Mark's Garage in downtown Honolulu.
Making heroin is a billion-dollar business, as is making its prescription substitutes. Does this president feel the pain of a full-blown opioid crisis?
4 in 5 new heroin users started out by misusing prescription drugs.
Big Pharma's opioid options for 21st century junkies. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
More and more station members are choosing continuous monthly giving as their preferred way to financially support Hawaii Public Radio and its work. Mahalo to sustaining members Bonnie Lisa Pestana of IAEA, Carrie Taggart and Steve Mobley of Honolulu, and John and Sarah Kaskin of Kailua. Sustaining membership is steadily lowering the amount of day-to-day operating support needed to be raised over the air. And to become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, you can call us at 955-8821 during business hours or just go online and donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for today's programming comes from Kahilu Theater. Joanne Folletta conducts the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra in an evening of music by Fauré, Dvorak, and Beethoven, Friday, April 8th at 7 p.m. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
Educational assistants in the classroom play a key role in helping special education students stay on track. So why do they face few training options, and why are they paid so little? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
It seems that these assistants, who really do play a crucial role in helping to keep the kids focused on what they need to do and to be sort of the second arm of the teacher, particularly with special education students, really important people, but that's not necessarily how it's reflected in what they're paid and how they find educational opportunities.
You know, Jessica Terrell opens her story with a Hawaii woman and her 12-year-old son. The son is deaf, is described as medically fragile. Since kindergarten, the child has had 7, maybe 8 educational assistants, and the best one of the bunch actually left for a better-paying job at Costco. And this is the real reality check, is that these key positions, these, yes, exactly, EAs, they're also called paraprofessionals or teacher's aides. These educational assistants really find the work not only very tough, but it just doesn't pay very well. In fact, the starting level salary is less than what cafeteria workers or low-level school custodians make, about $25,600. Just not something really rewarding financially. Not only that, they may not qualify for union representation. It depends on the gig. And there's really limited professional development opportunities for them as well. So because of that, well, no surprise, we have a serious vacancy rate. About 25% of the part-time positions are vacant right now. For the full-time positions, there's over 230 vacancies right now.
I mean, it should be said that these people are not just there to shepherd children, but they're actually engaged and actively working with them, and that they perform such a vital function. Why does it seem to be that the DOE doesn't recognize that in either pay or other opportunities?
I think the Department of Education, the Board of Education, advocacy groups, lawmakers do recognize that there is a problem. There is actually a bill at the legislature right now that would allow for a stepping stone position for EAs, maybe to get to become an actual teacher, a classroom teacher. There might be some financial assistance. But the bottom line is that they're just not being paid enough. But the work is very demanding. In Hawaii, EAs are only assigned to work with special ed students. Anybody that's ever had a special ed child knows how difficult that can be. When there's a shortage, the school actually has to contract out for those positions. And, of course, that only adds to the load. And it's not something that comes without any skills. They have to have good writing skills, algebra skills. What their job is to try and keep special ed students up with their peers. This is a very essential function, and yet we still have this challenge. I mean, imagine as a parent, you grow comfortable with an educational assistant for your child, and then that person has to leave because they're getting a better paying job at Costco.
Right, especially when that child is not only making you feel comfortable, but doing really well by your child.
Right, exactly. And that communication link that is formed is so essential right now. So the DOE, the BOE recognizes this. They're trying to do something about it. But remember, we already have another problem with qualified special ed teachers. There's a shortage there as well. So this is compounded with a shortage of EAs. They are different positions. Another problem is there really isn't the educational pathway in Hawaii towards getting those skills. An associate degree is needed, but there's some limitations in terms of what's being offered professionally.
All right, well, we got to leave that now, and that's unfortunate. We're going to have to pick this up later, but right now we need to find out what's happening in the rest of the world. We're going to go now to the news from the BBC. Thanks, Chad.
And tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, you're looking at aviation history, yeah?
Yeah, you know, Hawaii has been a crossroad for aviation for quite a while. And we thought we'd invite some of the folks over at the Pacific Aviation Museum and kind of give us a sense of, you know, what kind of history has Hawaii played in aviation. And then also kind of tie it into the Solar Impulse that's actually out there, ready to take its flight, to the West Coast. So, you know, there's a whole, I think, rich history and stories about, you know, how Hawaii has been sort of a crossroad for some of these interesting events.
And as you said, with the Solar Impulse, it's not just the past but the future, yeah?
Exactly. So, you know, there's a lot of past, and the past is, some of it is curated and housed in the Pacific Aviation Museum. So that's, of course, a rich place to, you know, learn about some of the things that happened, especially with World War II. But then, you know, there is the Solar Impulse, which is heading off to the West Coast, completing its second half of the around-the-world voyage, and it's being done 100% clean energy. So that's an interesting story as well. And, you know, it could be, it's definitely history in the making.
Sure. And so the whole work of the Pacific Aviation Museum is not just tracing what has happened already, but what's going to.
Yeah, we have, in fact, you know, we got lucky, and we got the Burl Burlingame, who used to write for the Advertiser way back when, and then it was Star Bulletin, I think, and then, you know, he is a historian over there, but he actually wrote a bunch of pieces on Solar Impulse, so we get to pick his brain about a bunch of different things.
Well, and people can call in and pick you guys' brains, too.
Of course, we're live in
the studio. As always. Brains for the picking. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing.
Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Aloha. I'm Leslie Klein. I'm a professional fiddle player living in Honolulu. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
Thank you.
You might remember that just a few weeks ago, the draft report on Kauai pesticide use was released by the Joint Fact-Finding Study Group, and it was received a little differently depending on who was commenting. The head of the Department of Agriculture, Scott Enright, largely dismissed the report, pointing to inconclusive evidence of harm. Others, including Paul Achitoff of Earth Justice, saw something else, the need to get the EPA involved. Paul Achitoff joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Kauai has been such a focus over the last 4 years of so much activity surrounding GMOs and pesticide use and a community in driving legislation, wanting to have disclosure, wanting to have buffer zones, wanting to know what was happening within itself. And then we were really told that it's the state who should be doing that. Do you see the state taking up its part?
I think it's clear the state is not doing its part. People may have followed to some extent these county ordinances that were passed a couple of years ago to try and get county level regulation of the pesticides and GMOs being used by the industry, and the lower court found that the state was the proper entity to be doing the regulation, and yet the state has done nothing to actually be responsive to the community's concerns. So I think that as the evidence mounts that more needs to be done and the state is refusing to do it, I think the federal government has to step in, and it is stepping in.
As you talk about the state not having enough, or that there not being enough evidence, when the report was reviewed, part of what the study group itself said, that it was hampered by a lack of exposure data, lack of limited health and environmental data, access to proprietary information, changing science, all kinds of things that might have brought different results had they had better and more effective data, which we just don't have because they weren't doing anything original. They were looking at whatever else existed. Does that in part mean that we don't really have a true baseline for this?
I think you can say that well, certainly what we know is that we don't have evidence that can conclusively either discount or substantiate a lot of the claims and counterclaims that are being said. So the way that Mr. Enright chose to characterize this is, well, that means there's no problem because we don't have conclusive proof. I think that's very irresponsible. What the draft report said was quote, there are important indications that signal Hawaii's political, regulatory, and community leaders need to be far more attentive to pesticide issues because we do have evidence that very potent pesticides, which can cause very substantial harm, are getting into the environment where they are not supposed to be, where they are legally precluded from being. And the state is neither doing any kind of consistent monitoring or sampling or enforcing of the laws. It's really abdicated its responsibility, yet at the same time, of course, claiming that it alone has the authority to be doing these things. So we clearly have a problem, and it's not going to be solved by the state saying there is no problem.
And from what you've just said, quite possibly not solved by the state at all, if already you've been able to have conversations with the EPA and that they are interested in doing their own investigation, plus what has been spinning around since January with the Syngenta workers who were taken to hospital and so many other issues that seem to be spinning in the same circle of this. Is there only the federal arm in your mind that is able to look at it at a high enough level to be able to affect change?
Well, for the time being, I think that's the case. In June of this year, I'm anticipating we will have arguments before the Court of Appeals on all of the cases that addressed the county ordinances, which sought to address at the local level some of these problems to some extent. If the Court of Appeals concludes that the counties have more authority than the lower court judge concluded, then we may see the counties taking some action or reinstating the action that the counties have already taken. But if the counties cannot take action and the state continues to refuse to take action, then of course the federal government is responsible for doing various things. And in fact, the EPA has already responded to a request that I made on behalf of a number of organizations to investigate the poisoning of a number of farm workers on Syngenta's property in January. They are going to be coming out here, and they are going to be doing an investigation. And I think I know that they are taking the matter very seriously, because this is not the first time that worker protection standards have been violated. I say in the past they have been violated. We'll see whether they've been violated in this case, but people were sent to the hospital. That suggests things were not handled properly in one way or another. And, of course, as you say, there are a lot of things happening. There are a variety of poisoning incidences. This is not a unique situation by any means. There have been, you know, there was a recent court decision in the class action against DuPont Pioneer, finding that DuPont Pioneer had failed to follow accepted practices. There are chlorpyrifos, a very toxic chemical, a pesticide found in the drainage canals out in Kakaha, which flow into the ocean and where, you know, they're open ditches. I mean, one thing after another, and yet the state says things like, well, we don't have conclusive proof, there's no problem. That's not going to be allowed to be the status quo.
Has there been any exchange with the state since the draft came out, or any discussion with either the governor or with Scott Enright? From your group or from the groups that you represent?
No. I have not spoken to Scott. I have not spoken with the governor. I did read in the paper that a group of people spoke with the governor after the draft joint fact-finding report came out. I was not involved in that, so I only know what I read in the paper.
Would you be open to sitting down and speaking with them?
Of course. I'd be open to speaking with them any time. I'd be happy to do that, but I think what I want to see is action, not more talk.
So why do you think up to this point that if you don't believe that, you know, the governor of the state has done enough, do you believe that they have some core understanding of what the agribusiness community brings to Hawaii that might be a different point of view than what you have?
Are you asking me if I understand why the governor views the industry differently than I might?
Yes.
I don't know what is going through the governor's mind. I do think, from what I have read over the years, that the reports that are put out in the media about the value of the industry to Hawaii are grossly exaggerated. When I read that the GMO seed industry is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, the obvious question is, to whom? It's worth that to the companies, but they send all of their product outside the state, so none of that money is being spent in the Hawaii economy. Yes, they do account for a few hundred jobs. Jobs are important, but there are other important things, such as protecting people's health and the environment. And there are other uses that prime agricultural land can be used for, such as feeding the local population, as well as putting people to work growing that food.
We see a lot of disconnects in this larger conversation that we've been having for now many years. Do you see any way around having to go through lots of deep litigation to be able to keep communities from perhaps tearing themselves apart?
Well, I wish I could say the answer was sure I do, but I don't. And I don't see the state government taking the kind of role that I think is called for here. And unless and until they do, I and other people will be doing what we can to address the situation. I will be seeking help from the EPA, additional help. I will be filing lawsuits that I believe are well-founded in law. I will be pursuing all avenues, and of course there are others that will be doing the same thing. Sometimes, unfortunately, local governments refuse to do the right thing until they are forced to do so by pressure of federal intervention or litigation. It may not be what we all prefer, but unfortunately, that's the way things sometimes play out.
For the moment, we have to say goodbye, and we'll be watching as this plays out over the next few months. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, Beth Ann.
Paul Achitoff is the managing attorney for the Hawaii Office of Earth Justice and handles a variety of public interest environmental litigation, including endangered species, water pollution, stream restoration, genetically modified organisms and pesticides. A public informational briefing by the Joint Fact-Finding Study Group is scheduled for next Monday night in the Kauai Veterans Theater in Lihue.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Today's backyard quiz, we talked about a migratory bird that leaves its Alaska breeding ground every year and spends the colder months in Hawaii. It changes the plumage. It's plumage for the trip. In Alaska, it's mostly black and white. In Hawaii, it's gold and brown. The Alaska to Hawaii migration is a 3,000-mile trip, and it's a feat of endurance because there are no stops for food or rest along the way. It's also a feat of navigation, because even the youngest of these birds is able to pinpoint the Hawaiian Islands at the end of its ocean voyage, and scientists have yet to figure out just how they do it. We asked you for its name, our names. The Latin name is Pluvialis fulva, and we didn't expect you to know that, but we did hope you would recognize the Kolea, our Pacific golden plover.
And boy, did we have lots of people who did. All right. It was a very popular quiz this morning. But our winner is David Gomes from Kohala, who phoned in first and fast and is going to get the T-shirt. So there you go. Thanks very much for playing the Backyard Quiz with us this morning. And if you've got a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Günter Hasinger from the Institute of Astronomy of the University of Hawaii, Manoa. You are listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
All the grace, ceremony, and ritual of Japanese culture are present in the tea ceremony, and opportunities to see it performed in all its wealth of detail are rare. But this Saturday, the Lauai International Center on Kauai will host a ceremony to which the public is invited. Lynn Morimoto is the center's president, and she's on the phone from there. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning.
What is it about the tea ceremony that is so special to you?
Well, what we are having at our center, this is a very extraordinary experience. It is actually way beyond tea. The reason for this is the tea ceremony practice, which is over 1,000 years old, is being held in a hand-carved traditional 13th century Japanese structure called the Hall of Compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And so while this ceremony is taking place there, the participants will be able to experience the ladies who will be moving in this most beautiful ceremony. It's beyond the ceremony. You're in this infinite space in the Hall of Compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it transcends tea. It is balancing the entire body, mind, and spirits and souls of the individuals who come to this to the center to experience this. It will be a multi-dimensional experience for all participants.
How do,
beyond the physical realm.
Well, Lynn, how would someone who really is not familiar with it, how do they get into that space that you're talking about?
Really, you don't need to get into a space, because within everyone's soul, spirit, and self, they identify this innate memory of being at home. And so that's what happens when people enter the grounds of Lawai International Center. It's a warm, comforting, balanced space, and it's even more amplified once you're in the Hall of Compassion. In Japan, this traditional style of 13th century hand-carved tradition is where the general public does not enter. It is only for the chosen ones to enter a structure of this nature. At Lawai International Center, the public is welcome to enter and experience this very serene, tranquil tea ceremony gathering, which is rarely done in a space like this.
Lynn, when you say only the chosen ones are ordinarily allowed, what's behind that? What chosen how?
Usually in Japan, the priests who have gone through their own rites of passage, they are the ones who then can enter this inner sanctum. However, the Hall of Compassion, which is of this traditional style, was created most uniquely in the whole world by masters from Asia and volunteers from the island and throughout the country. It will remain standing for a minimum 1,000 years, and it's one of the last of this tradition to be built in the United States.
Well, it sounds as if by making it more of a public ceremony, some of that tradition maybe has shifted from the way it's implemented in Japan, yeah?
Definitely. Well, Lawai International Center, from the creation of this hand-carved structure, shifted a tradition that's over 1,000 years old. Because for over 1,000 years, the wisdom came from the heart of the master to the heart of the next generation master. When this structure came out, the wisdom came up. The wisdom was passed on from the heart of the master to the hearts of the volunteers, to Western volunteers, which had never been done for over 1,000 years. So we shifted paradigms, which is a way to shift all paradigms, all to the greater for total balance, harmony.
It sounds as if Lynn...
being compassion of the heart.
Lynn, it sounds as if in those shifting of paradigms, there's some altering of them as well, maybe for a Western audience.
Yes, and when the people come and they experience this, they can also, we also have 88 shrines on a hillside built by the first Japanese immigrants. People can partake on doing this walk on the hillside, which is over 1,000 years old in Japan. It was created in 1904 by the first group of Japanese immigrants coming to Hawaii. And so they can leave the grounds transformed by this entire total experience.
Well, it sounds
like there are secret sites all over the world, and at the same time, it's the commitment of the hearts of the people that open up these energies. And that's what has happened here in Lauai.
Well, it sounds like a rare opportunity, Lynn. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you for this great opportunity, and I hope you come and experience the moment in Lauai.
Sounds great. Thank you. Lynn Morimoto is the president of the Lauai International Center in Koloa, Kauai, which is offering a traditional Japanese tea ceremony this Saturday at the center's Hall of Compassion. Admission is free, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
New research shows having colleagues who work from home can have negative effects on the folks who do come to the office every day.
So you had people who would come to the office and literally none of their coworkers would be there, either because they were out and about or they were working in other locations or they were choosing to work from home.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Bethann, we've had youth candidates before in presidential elections, and I'm thinking back when college students were clean for Eugene McCarthy in the 68 election, you know, and there's a tendency for the youth voter to want to support the gadfly candidate, as Bernie Sanders has been on the Democratic side. The question, as always, with youth voters is, are they going to follow through?
Well, that is the question that we're going to wait and see.
Yeah.
But the point that I think we were hearing this morning from Neil Milner is that we can't discount the long-term political engagement and civic engagement that happens with millennials. And especially when you think about the leading edge of millennials this year, turning 35, we're not just talking about kids anymore, and we maybe have to rethink how we characterize them.
More than likely.
That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday morning. We'll be back tomorrow, and you probably have noticed that Waikiki is changing and has been in the news a lot with it. Bidding war for Starwood and a possible 350-foot tower proposed for King's Village property. We're going to find out what that means for the community as seen through the eyes of Chaminade Professor of Political Economy, Christopher McNally.
And we'll celebrate the launch of National Poetry Month on Maui with poet Jane Hirschfield. You can post your comments to us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
And you can leave your comments at 808-792-8217.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them under The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow morning for The Conversation.